This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Is it just me, or has everyone else made your life miserable too? I keep coming to the realization that you complaining about not getting your way means I can't have mine. You not admitting your own misbehavior means I can't have fun. You trying to take someone else's money by way of a lawsuit means I'm considered a greedy potential plaintiff as well. The Hook recently discussed the downtown mall's community fountains. Seems their original design of being publicly interactive has given way to being chained up and turned off. Why? Because if you slip and fall around a water fountain, something scientifically possible, you feel the need to blame the city rather than Lady Luck. If your child drinks the water, instead of taking responsibility for possible poor parenting, you blame the city for offering something they haven't bothered to sterilize and fill with fluoride. I just want to sit beside the splashing water on a nice sunny day. But because of your behavior, I can't have my fun. Liability is a common word when discussing why my pleasure has been interrupted. Yes, I could hurt myself skating at Mr. Carmine's pond. But I wouldn't sue him if I did fall. However, you make the former community place a liability. The man must have had 40 pairs of ice skates in his garage, various sizes for various ages. He loved having the neighborhood come over and skate, calling us up when the pond finally froze over. But you have taken that fun out of my life. Someone actually falling down while ice skating is a probability. But you make it a liability. Because of you, I can't have a carefree party. Behave yourself. Don't make me do it for you. Because of you, there's barely a playground swing for my nephews. Kids can't handle a knee scab. Because of you, many businesses fail to donate excess food to people and places that could use it. Liability scares charity. Because of you, I get this pile of crappy email every day. If you'd stop opening the junk and falling for the fake web links, this stuff would end as insolvent. Because of you, I can't enjoy a snowstorm the way I used to. Assuming you haven't killed winter temperatures altogether with your SUV, you make me come to work early and stay late. Actually, now that I think about it, it's not you, it's them. All right, boys and girls, here we are, the last Sunday of January 2007. That's right, we're already 1/12 through 2007. I still haven't put away all the Christmas presents that I brought from home. Let's see, a very interesting topic for the day today with a guest who hasn't been in the studio for quite some time. Alexis, how many years has it been since you were here?
Oh, it's been 4 or 5 years at least.
Has it? Alexis Ziegler, you were in here before for Trade Local.
Yep, that was an organization we put together to try to encourage people to shop locally.
Successful?
Successful for a year or two. It was, I chose not to focus on it in the long term. We still have a website, tradelocal.org, that has just some general information on it. We used to run a database, online database of, locally owned businesses, and we haven't really kept that up.
And, it was eventual, or that you were shot down when Target opened up?
Well, there are no shortage of opportunities for people to not shop locally. I've been involved in a number of causes around town. That was one of them. I also worked with Siebel Indie Media. I also worked with the city to put the bike lanes in town years ago, and currently work with the Community Bikes Program, which is a bike shop on downtown Main Street. So I've worked with a lot of causes in town, and some of them end up falling by the wayside over time.
Alexis is a civil activist. Is that a good word for you?
Sure, that'll do.
Civil activist and an author, which is why he's in the studio today. An author of his book, which I left in the car, Cultural Change, Civil Liberty, Peak Oil, and the End of Empire. And, you know, let's jump into this. It's a big, long, you know, it seems very popular to, if you have a book that is serious, you have to have a lot of words in the title. Cultural change, but then there's always the colon or semicolon, and then the sort of subtitle.
Yeah.
Why the need?
Well, honestly, you know, you're trying to sell the book. You're trying to put something on the cover that is at least going to grab people's attention. So, peak oil is something that people have been talking about. Civil liberty is something people have been talking about with the Patriot Act and things like that. And empire is another topic that David Corton and others have been publishing about recently. And the purpose of the book and the purpose of the title is to tie together and get people thinking in a much broader, much more holistic sense. I think there are various aspects of our culture and various aspects of the way our academic culture works, and I'm not an academic, so I speak about that from the outside, that tends to segment reality a lot. So I'm trying to tie together, you know, peak oil and civil liberty, for instance. People tend to think of those as being completely separate, quote-unquote, issues, and I think they're directly and intimately tied. And underlying this book is a broader theory of cultural evolution and cultural change that, my theory, if you want to put it in those terms, that ties together all of these things. And I might be right and I might be wrong, but I do think it's really important to start thinking about things in much broader terms. I think our culture is, our society, global industrial society, is getting to the point where things already change very quickly, but the coming limitations of oil supply, which is absolutely inevitable. It might be 2 months away, it might be 20 years away, but it's inevitable. That's a huge change, and I don't think we are in any way prepared for that. And I think, you know, people look at that as a technological issue, and frankly, I don't think we're going to be cold, dark, and hungry anytime soon. But I think the political fallout from that, the impacts on our social culture, on our civil liberties, on how our political system works, concerns me much more. I think that is something we're not particularly aware of, and it could have enormous impacts on us.
You know, and that's one of the things that found good and bad about the book. I told you before we started I'd be upfront with my abilities in reading the book. It was done in a very well-edited manner. It's not a really long book for everybody, and hopefully a large number of people will be interested in finding the book and reading it as we go through the hour. They'll want to take notes on where they can pick it up. It wasn't that long. How many pages was it?
It's 130 pages or so.
Yeah, I mean, we're not talking about some thick academic textbook, but the topic, it was very broad. You know, as you tried to cover and sort of tie these things together, at times I almost found it to be conspiratorial. Do you think that's fair?
Well, conspiracy in the sense that evolution is a conspiracy. I mean, I think there is a process of cultural evolution that happens over time. And it's like you can look at biological evolution if you believe in the Darwinian theory, which I do. And it looks like there was a conspiracy there to make things a certain way. And cultural evolution is the same way, in that over time there's this stress and response process that big cultures and small cultures too go through, whereby ecological limits occur or population grows, and they have to develop new technologies, new means of producing food, new means of social organization, and different social movements compete vie for different solutions to those stressors. And it's kind of an evolutionary process, so that over time it does kind of look like a conspiracy. And, you know, rich, given that our world today is very much divided, rich and poor, certainly rich people try to hold on to their wealth, try to expand their wealth, and have a lot of power to do so. So there is, you know, and there's certain element of conspiracy at that level of culture as well.
All right. We are talking with Alexis Ziegler, author and civil activist, new book, Cultural Change. printed here in Charlottesville. And where can you pick that up, by the way?
You can pick it up at New Dominion Bookstore. You can also get it on my website, which is conev.org. That's conev.org. And just a minor correction there, it's actually culture change, not cultural change.
Ah, see, I can't type properly.
Well, it's funny. Everybody changes that. I'm not sure why. But in any case, my website's a good place to get it, conev.org, C-O-N-E-V, .org. It's $10 postage paid. We'll bring it to you.
All right, let's start right from the top. Because I already feel like we've gotten a little bit out of sync here.
Uh-huh.
In a nice, easy, non-academic sentence, what is the focus of the book?
The focus of the book is about how cultures evolve and how the economic, ecological levels of culture influence our politics and beliefs.
Okay. Tell me, you know, what's the first question when you're looking into this to write your book? What's the question that started this for you?
For me personally, I was kind of a boy scientist. You know, a lot of kids grow up tinkering with erector sets and electronic this, that, and the other.
I had tinker toys.
Oh yeah, and I took apart every machine in the house. Grew up on a farm. Would stay up late at night taking things apart and putting them back together. And was very much into, you know, at the age of 5, was very determined to be a scientist. By the age of 7, I guess, at a very young age, I realized, you know, this world has plenty of scientists, and the whole physical realm is not a problem. It's the social realm that we don't understand very well. And I also grew up in a very Christian family, so it was actually very sort of ethically motivated from a Christian stance at that point. But for me, it's a basic curiosity. Why is the world organized the way it is? When I walk down the street and I see the houses, why does everybody live in a separate house? Not other cultures don't do that. I see people walking down the street. Why do men have short hair and why do women have long hair? Because, you know, that's the pattern. And every little thing is a riddle to me. You know, why do people eat what they eat? Why do they, why does our culture do what it does in any realm? And, you know, I feel like I put years and years of work into this and have better answers for some of those questions than others. But I think what happens, or what's happened for me is, you know, whether one disagrees or agrees with my theory, you build together this process of understanding cultures. And as I say, I think it's this stress and response process as cultures grow. And the funny thing about it is I think it's a blind process. To me, it's really bizarre. I mean, we're sitting here in a radio studio with all this technology around us. How incredibly sophisticated we are. We can make all these electronic gizmos. And yet you can't ask the average person on the street or even the average academic why men dominate women all over the world. Surely men aren't smarter or stronger particularly. I mean, men are a little stronger on average, but that's not the reason. Why is it that we're so incredibly sophisticated in one realm and so incredibly unaware in other realms? I mean, our entire industrial society is based on fossil fuel. We know fossil fuels are going to run out. Nobody argues with that point. We don't know exactly how quickly. We're not particularly making any preparations for that. Why is that? Is that not bizarre? Am I, you know, I'm not the first one to point that out, naturally, but for me, it extends out. You can't get a decent answer for why poor people are poor. So for me, this sort of underlying theory of how do cultures evolve, how do they change, and again, I think it's largely a non-conscious process. I mean, rich people do try to influence the politics of our culture more so than poor people. It's because they have more power, they have more access to the media and whatnot. But even they don't really understand what's going on, and that's pointedly clear from our current political leadership, without going off on that tangent. But so for me, it's kind of at the base of it's kind of a scientific question, just why? And beyond that, it's an ethical question and an activist question. Well, okay, if we understand this, what can we do about it? Which is much harder, of course.
All right, 979-0919. If you have questions or comments on the topic today, my goal for the hour is to have Alexis teach me a little more so that I can understand it better. I would love for people to call up and ask questions so that you know, you feel better educated, or you realize that I just asked the stupid question. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. I see the phone line ringing right now, so try not to ask something that's too difficult. By the way, if you are listening and you missed the first little bit, www.cvillepodcast.com. com, or if you, for whatever reason, have somewhere to go and aren't going to be here to catch the whole hour, you can catch the end of it on the web. Nathan, are you there?
I am.
We got Nathan from Charlottesville. Fire away, my man.
Hey, Alexis, curious if you've got a point or two or three that you might share with us that kind of summarizes how we can bring the theory down to every day, what you do in your life.
Well, that's an interesting approach, because I find it very frustrating that a lot of my fellow environmentalists, and I consider myself an environmentalist, I think answer that question in a fairly narcissistic kind of way, because it's a fairly narcissistic kind of culture. So they say, you know, get a more efficient car, get more efficient light bulbs, whatever. I think, you know, beyond trying to educate yourself about the issues, I think it's really important to understand these things in the social context, to understand that for addressing this upcoming age of tremendous change that we're going to face, that we really need to be talking to other people, to thinking about, you know, not just what kind of light bulb am I going to put into my house, but how do we organize ourselves as a society? Just sit in a coffee shop and say, okay, well, you know, why is it that everybody has to commute to work and we just assume that that's what everybody wants to do? Well, that's a cultural value. It's a choice we made. So I know that's a little harder than just going out and buying the light bulb, but I think that's far more important to start talking about and thinking with people about how to do things differently. There's a new barter network in town, sort of a local currency system, which... that is one small example. You can get to that barter network through Trade Local, by the way, tradelocal.org. That's an example of people working together to come up with a different system. Now, you know, realistically, that's not going to take off and take over the city in the next 6 months, but 10 years from now, it might, because alternative currencies have actually done really well in times of economic contraction, which we're going to have when peak oil comes in. So the answer to that is I really think it's important what we do with other people. Get involved with something, working with other people. That's my answer.
All right, Nathan. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
By the way, there you go. 979-0919. Nathan started you off. Feel free to dial up. 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Economic contraction. Explain that a little bit. You say it's coming. Economic contraction is coming.
Well, it is, although it's going to be mythologized. You have to realize, I may have just created a word there, but that there are these tremendous economic shifts that have gone on in our history under the surface of our society and will happen in our future, but nobody stands up and tells you that's what's happening. We went through a significant shift in the 1970s with the limitations of the oil supply, and what had happened at that point, people look at the OPEC embargoes, 1973, and then there was another set of issues that happened in 79, and say, oh, well, that was just politics. Well, it wasn't politics. What had happened is that the global economy was growing so quickly that the distance between supply and demand of oil had gotten so close that a fairly minor political disruption, the amount of oil withheld by OPEC was very, very small, but it caused this huge ripple in terms of the economic impacts. It was enormous. When you look at the growth rates, I mean, they fell, particularly in the late 70s, early 80s. Yet we see that in very politicized terms. Now, in terms of the quote-unquote contraction that we're coming to, we have to realize that there are a lot of spiffy alternative energies out there. Some of them are going to work better than others. Some of them might be fairly dangerous. If you want to talk about biofuel, we can talk about that in a minute. But oil comes out of the ground really cheaply, really easily. And we've had this tremendous period of global economic growth based on that oil. And whatever alternative energy system we deal with is not going to be as cheap and as easy as oil, and there are going to be tremendous political and cultural impacts flowing from that. And I also would say, a slightly more sophisticated point that's also no more than common sense, the planet is 8,000 miles across, 24,000 miles around. We know that. We know that it's a finite Earth. And yet we have this myth of progress, this myth of infinite growth that is obviously a myth. It's crazy. We can't grow forever. So at some point, the economy has to stop growing. And I think it's actually likely to contract because of the contraction of the energy supply. But even if we had an infinite energy supply, the economy could not keep growing as it's growing. It just can't. That's a physical impossibility.
All right, 11:20 here with Alexis Ziegler, author of Culture Change and local civil activist. Feel free to dial us up, 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's the toll-free line. Let me take a moment and tell you the markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and Shenandoah Valley. Mostly cloudy today. Highs 40 to 45. In Richmond, it maybe get to the lower 50s. Cloudy and possible snow showers tonight. Lows 25 to 30. Sunny tomorrow. Highs 35 to 40. Right now, it's clear in the valley and 42. But it's cloudy elsewhere in the listening area, 44 in Lynchburg, 49 in Richmond, and 39 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
All right. Got the phone line ringing, but we had somebody call in. Alexis, and wanted you to talk a little bit more about peak oil.
Well, I would point out, first of all, there is a local website, sevillepeakoil.org, not hyphenated. There's a couple of other good...
And for those who can't spell that, I mean, and I'm not trying to be silly, but P-E-A-K-O-I-L.
Right.
Because there's... I've already discovered in my preparation for this that some people weren't sure exactly because of my slurring from my Chesapeake Bay birth area. Weren't sure what the heck I was saying.
That's a local website that links to a couple of other websites. The two sort of national or international websites that I find the most useful are energybulletin.net and the Oil Drum, which is, I think, the oildrum.org or .com. I don't remember which. Oops. In any case, peak oil is about the growth of energy supplies and their limitations. Oil production, as we all know, has been growing for quite some time. Right now it's around 85 million barrels a day. There are quite a number of oil geologists at this point saying that they don't think it's going to grow a lot more. Not that we're running out of oil, but that simply at some point it can't continue to grow and eventually starts to fall off. The point at which oil production is likely to cease to grow, based on experience in other oil fields, is at the point at which approximately half of the oil in the oil field, or in this case, the world's oil, has been used. The theory is that there's give or take 2 trillion barrels of oil, accessible oil, near the surface of the earth, and we've used close to a trillion. Anybody who studies this issue honestly has to tell you that it's such big and complex that nobody can say that peak oil is going to happen next week or next month or even next year. But there are a lot of indications. Global oil production has been nearly flat for the last couple of years. A lot of the big producers, Saudi Arabia, has been flat for a long time now. Russia is actually producing more than Saudi Arabia right now. So there are a lot of indications that it's not going to grow a lot more. It's certain, a tremendous amount of debate about that issue. But for me, my approach to it, or the real important question for me, is why don't we approach that in a more intelligent fashion? Because I think our culture, by its very design, is sort of systematically teaches people to not look at big issues, to not look at these challenging sort of basic issues that are very, at the foundation or the structure of our economy. And that, to me, is the most important question, because I think if we're going to have a sane and livable culture in 50 or 100 years, it's not going to be so much a technological question. I mean, it's interesting to look at the technology, but it's going to be a social question. Can we navigate these tremendous changes without, falling apart or becoming something less than a democracy or whatever? So that's what I try to address in the book. That's what I try to work on.
All right, we're here with Alexis Ziegler as he talks about his book, Culture Change. And we're taking a call from Witt. Hey, Witt.
Hey, man, how you doing?
Good, good.
I apologize if you've addressed this because I haven't been listening for a few minutes. I was curious, the comment about the economy slowing down, which makes perfect sense, but I was also curious about if you look at the industrial growth, and how everything we basically do is done in an extremely fast, inefficient way that has given us buildings that aren't healthy and don't work, and neighborhoods that don't work, and products that are unsafe, that wouldn't there possibly be almost an equal amount of time, at least, associated with the redesign of these things and fixing them, you know, redeveloping decayed inner cities and buildings that aren't going to last, re-engineering, you know, the products that we use so that they're safer and healthier. I mean, isn't there a substantial amount of basically a new type of industrial revolution available?
All right.
Well, I think there needs, if we are going to navigate this whole change successfully, I think it is going to take a tremendous reorganization of the infrastructure of our society. There's a Hirsch report that was conducted by the commission by the Department of Energy that said just that. It was a risk assessment report. And the summary of that report says, you know, it's going to take decades to make this change. The past changes that we've gone through, we went from wood to coal and coal to oil, that happened over the course of decades. And there's this whole retooling that has to happen just at the physical level in terms of you know, is UVA Hospital, this big, tremendous centralized facility, are we going to be helicoptering people in, you know, 20 or 50 years from now? Does that mean we need smaller hospitals? Does, you know, an 8 or 12 or 20-lane I-81 make sense when nobody can tell you what kind of fuel is going to be in the vehicles driving up and down that road? So just at the physical level, there's a tremendous amount of time and effort that would need to go into the retooling of society for it to be more sustainable.
That makes sense.
All right, thanks, Whit.
All right, thank you.
All right, join in with the other folks who've called in, 979-0919. I apologize for my cold, but believe me, it's not contagious over the airwaves. 979-0919, 1-877 WNRN Rocks. We want to thank 45fix.com for their support today. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate, no obligation estimates are available anytime. That's the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. All right, 1128 with author Alexis Ziegler as we talk about his book, Culture Change. Dial us up. Civil liberty plays a big part in your book. Define that for us.
Well, I put it in a historical context, and again, I'm looking for, you know, how does this really evolve? Why does it really change? Because I think our whole notion of putting the founding fathers up on a pedestal and Western civilization, oh, we created democracy, it was this conscious, purposeful intention of these smart white men, is it's our mythology, it's our cultural story, and every culture has its own story, and every culture lives within its story. I think when you look at the history of democracy, you can look at it particularly in Greek and Roman civilization, because they're far enough back and enough separate from us that you can get a little more objectivity, I think. And if you look at the Greeks, the peak of their democratic period occurred early in their empire, and they were a small empire, but they were an empire. Their island wasn't, there wasn't enough agricultural output to support a growing population. They developed this colonialism, went around the Mediterranean, conquered, dominated other lands, brought the resources home, and developed a market economy there. And it was the first significantly scaled civilization really dependent on a market economy. And those traders basically needed more social liberty to be economically viable. If the government or the landed aristocracy was controlling them too much, it wouldn't work economically. So they pressed for more civil liberty and gained more civil liberty over time. A couple of things to say from that. First of all, as that empire aged and became militarily overextended, democracy itself declined. They reverted back to monarchy. I think you can see the same patterns in the United States in that, again, we tend to think of it in very political terms. And, you know, I'm an activist. I've been tear gassed and arrested and organized campaigns and all this stuff. You know, from the activist perspective.
That's cool.
Well, it sounds...
Afterwards.
Yeah, it's cool afterwards, exactly. But anyway, you know, from the activist perspective, you can see it in the street that when people get organized, they make changes, and changes don't happen until people get organized. They don't happen automatically. It's not like some dark economic force just suddenly makes things different. But I think what happens is that as these economic shifts occur, they create different opportunities for different social movements. You can look at it, the history of women's, the position of women in American culture and cross-culturally is a pretty good example, I think. And that, you know, when I get out and talk about these subjects, I ask people, well, when did women first have the right to vote in the United States? And you know, several hands pop up and they say, oh, that was around World War One with the Suffrage Act. And I said, no, that's not true, actually. They had the right to vote in colonial America. They had the right to own property. And in colonial America, before the Revolution, men and women both worked in the field. It was an agrarian society. It was not gender equal, but it was better than the Victorian era. And what happened in the Victorian era was that men went to work in the factories and women stayed home. Suddenly, men were the breadwinners. Women lost the right to vote. They lost the right to inherit property. They lost the right to sit on juries. And you have to ask yourself, as a social activist, in the 1820s, were the women then stupid or lazy? I mean, what happened? Were they bad organizers? No. There was a structural economic shift that played to the favor of particular social movements that pushed them out of particular social economic realms.
So coal did that?
Not coal exactly. The shifting from an agrarian society to a breadwinner society where the male did all the work. If you look at it cross-culturally, a very simple cross-cultural correlation of how much power do women have in different cultures, the more women are economically integrated, the more power they have. And this is true for small cultures, big cultures, all over the world. You can even look at hunter-gatherers. The hunter-gatherers in Africa, where women produce the majority of the food, are more or less gender equal. They still have separate gender roles. Whereas the Inuit, the Eskimos that lived, polar areas, the men went out and did all the hunting and the women stayed and, you know, took care of the kids and whatnot. Those societies were more male-dominated, even though there were hunter-gatherers. But when the men become more economically, and I would also say militarily important, if we're a group of people and we're faced with some stress, even a small group of people, imagine you're on some boat and the boat's leaking out in the middle of the ocean, you're going to support the person who you think has a solution to fix the boat or whatever. Cultures tend to support through various symbolic and through various reward systems the members of their culture who can defend them if they're being threatened or who can deal with these stressors. And it's also just a power issue, particularly in a market economy, that whoever brings home the paycheck, you know, if you're a woman in a bad relationship but you don't have good economic opportunities, you're more likely to put up with more crap from your abusive spouse. Whereas, you know, and again, if you track that history out, the women's movement, it's not a coincidence. This big, successful feminist movement grew up in the 1960s when, you know, right on the heels of this tremendous expansion of women's employment after World War II. By the mid-1950s, there were more women in the workforce than there were at the peak of World War II. That's not a coincidence, which is not to say that the activist part doesn't matter. As an activist, I know it does. But we have to recognize that those structural economic changes underneath the surface what allows different social movements to succeed or fail. And that's really important coming up on this age of energy limitations. And in fact, we're facing a lot of limitations because growth can't go on forever on a finite planet. We have to ask ourselves, okay, so if peak oil is, let's say, just 5 years away to make up a number, what social movements is that going to favor? You know, what's that going to do to our political situation? And I have to say that given our current circumstance, it's going to favor reactionary movements. It's going to favor movements that want to take away our democracy. In fact, I would say it already is. I would say it goes back to, I would say that the beginning of the slope of the curve open growth and a slowing of growth occurred in the 1970s. That was an energy limit that we hit. And it did play to the favor of reactionary movements.
Such as? I mean, what's a reactionary movement? Define, you know, give me an example of one.
The neocons, I would call them reactionary. The people who want to corner the wealth for themselves, who want to decrease civil liberty. I don't want to pigeonhole too much, but...
I'm just looking for, I want to get my my small brain around it. You know, give me some examples.
Well, I think there
of
are
what
a lot
happened.
Of,
I'm not asking you to predict who's right. going to be reactionary right. in the future. I'm asking right. you to tell me who was reactionary in the past, at least from your. And I realize that it's your personal perspective.
Sure,
I'm not asking
sure.
you to, you know, well, to identify they, well, they were, the Britannica, you know, right. encyclopedia issue.
Right. Well, there were a variety of conservative movements, and they're not conservative in the traditional sense of conservatism, and I think that's a break that's happening now in the modern conservative movement. But there are a lot of movements out there that advocate for rich people, get paid very well to do it, and use a lot, you know, use issues like abortion and gay rights and all this, and you know, freedom and democracy and all this stuff to advance an agenda that restricts our civil liberty, that arranges the economy in such a way to shift more of the wealth from the poor to the wealthy. And, you know, if you get off into that politicized realm, then I think you start to get away from the cultural theory side of it. Because, and,
is that, am I correct in remembering that you think that that's intentionally done by some people to have you and I look at it at a political aspect so that we don't notice the more deeper cultural aspect and therefore don't try to do anything about it?
To a certain extent, I think it is, and I think it isn't. I mean, you know, when these guys, for instance, bringing the issue of gay rights into the elections, I mean, that was clearly very calculated to get a turnout of conservative voters. So at that level, it's calculated. At the level of, do these guys really have a long-term understanding of cultural evolution and where this whole thing is going? No, I don't think they do. I think it's headed in a direction that not even they would choose. I think that as our empire matures and becomes more militarily stressed, we're going to do exactly what the Romans did, exactly what the Greeks did. There's no reason we shouldn't. It's the same cultural evolutionary process that's been at work all along. And in the latter Roman Empire, they threw the scientists out. They threw the political advisors out and brought in the astrologers. It became this superstitious madhouse. Sound familiar?
Yeah, we have that here every Sunday.
Right. So these underlying economic changes can have some very negative impacts if we don't get our head around it. And this, you know, in this age, the ante's been upped. It's the change is on such a so much bigger scale that if we do let it fall apart, it's gonna be ugly. I mean, I think we do have a much better choice, which is, and the book talks about this some too, which is to consciously understand these things and to consciously begin redesigning our society. And nobody's going to come on the evening news and tell you, you know, stop shopping, stop buying the bigger houses, the bigger cars, stop pretending that growth can go on forever. They're not going to tell you that. This has to be a movement. It has to be a movement from the bottom up, intellectually, politically, and economically. And it has to be fundamentally economic. And that, I think, is that sort of big gap between a lot of what I say and a lot of what other activists say, because activists do tend to be focused on the politics. I think it's really important that we think about designing a society that can be sustainable in 20 or 30 years, and it's not going to look like, big fancy houses with nice light bulbs and a Prius out front. That ain't going to do it, I don't think, in my opinion. I think we're talking about some pretty fundamental social reorganization, which we can do purposefully, carefully. It can make society better, but it's quite a leap from where we are now.
All right, 11:39 here on the Wake Up Call. Dial us up, play along, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is the toll-free number. Alexis Ziegler is here as we talk about his new book, Culture Change.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, the cover story has a nationally respected Rolling Stone rock critic recalling life, personal loss, and music in 90s Charlottesville. Author John Grisham is the judge of The Hook's 2007 short story contest, so one of the world's top-selling authors will read your work even if you don't get any of the $1,000 in prizes. And there's the fourth annual Getting Hitched wedding insert. Prominent Charlottesvillians tell the stories of their courtship, wedding professionals dish on what happens when things don't go according to plan, and photographers share their favorite wedding shots and the stories behind them. Not just for brides. The Hook, providing culture here to Charlottesville. Let's thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support today. They are winter outfitters in Virginia for over 30 years. Blue Ridge has footwear that's warm and stylish, and they also stock genuine sheepskin Uggs. That's Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville and at BRMS.com. And don't be going anywhere, because in about 20 minutes, George Bell will be here for Les Temps Purdue. If French isn't your thing, that means the time's gone by. And on WNRN, that means late 80s and mid-90s alternative. Tune in for it at noon. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music, only on WNRN. All right, back in action with Alexis Ziegler. Feel free to dial us up, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. All right, Alexis, I want to talk a little bit about, and we'll come, you know, the civil liberty was important, and I want to come back into that in just a moment. But we were talking about the fuel issue, mm-hmm. and I feel like I missed an important bit of information that our listeners would be interested in. Ethanol, biodiesel, et cetera. Can you give us a few bits of information? Because one of the things that I found most interesting in the book was the ethanol versus food
right.
concept that you bring to light.
Yeah, it's funny because the whole biofuel movement is supported by, by a lot of leftists about, and of course President Bush in his recent speech, he says we're going to cut gasoline usage not by a conservation but by increases in the use of biofuels and other alternative fuels. Personally, I think it's madness for a few reasons. First of all, if you understand the history of biofuel, the entire early phase of the Industrial Revolution was fueled with biofuel. They used trees and firewood across Europe for the early phases of the Industrial Revolution, and they stripped the whole continent naked of forest. There was tremendous environmental cost to that. There's a conversion that civilizations go through, societies go through, where they use the easiest thing first. And trees are, in essence, a high-grade ore because they're right on the surface of the ground. You don't have to go 1,000 feet underground to get them, so you can chop them down. And as soon as they use up the high-grade ore, then they go to lower-grade ore. So they used up the shallow coal, they went to deeper coal and deeper coal. And the same thing happened in the United States, that the entire eastern seaboard was stripped of forest. This entire forest you see around you is second growth. Those trees were all burned, and they were gone by the mid-1800s. And that's when the major conversion to coal began. Of course, it didn't happen overnight. It was an incremental process. So there's tremendous environmental price to the history of biofuel. Since the mid-1800s, our population, of course, has grown quite a bit, and our energy use per capita has grown quite a bit. It's pretty much absolutely nuts at this point to think we can fuel industrial society with biofuel or even a major fraction of it. Just because we use so much energy, if we attack it from the supply side, there's going to be a huge environmental cost. And they are, in fact, doing that. I mean, there's tree chippers operating in our national forest grinding up trees to put them into the steam boilers and for electricity, which is nuts. There's simply not enough trees there to keep the lights on very long at all, and then the forest is going to be gone. Hopefully they won't cut down the whole thing. We'll see. The food versus fuel issue, you know, if we already lived in a world where there was a fairly equitable distribution of resources, I wouldn't be too worried about it, because then we could figure out how much biofuel can we produce, you know, what's the sustainable level, and do that over the long term. Given the inequalities that are already built into our global economic system, biofuel is throwing blood in the water with the sharks. It's bad news.
What do you mean?
Because of the disparity in buying power between you and me and people in undeveloped or third world, whatever you want to call it, we have the market power to take the
food.
Well,
they don't have cars.
No, but when our cars burn their food, we have the market power to take the food right out of their hands. Case in point, right now 10% of the global sugar supply is going into ethanol. Global raw sugar prices have doubled. So, you know, granted, we could talk about the nutritional value of sugar, but you know, for you or me, I don't own a car, but for an American putting gas in their car, they don't even think about that. But it is a global economic system right now. It takes 10 acres of grain land to fuel a car for a year. The global supply of grain land is 0.3 acres. 0.3, not...
Say that again, though.
10 acres to fuel a car.
10 acres of corn.
Of corn to fuel a car.
To fuel a car.
For a year. Three-tenths of an acre is how much grain land there is for each person on the face of the earth.
What you're saying is all that's set aside for me to eat or to put in my car
is 3/10.
It's 3/10 of an acre.
Right.
But if I want to use the corn for my car,
that's 10 acres.
So what's that, 30 times my share?
Right, right.
30 times my, well, my math is not so bad. 30 times my share.
Give or take.
To use just for my car. So I'm taking 29 other people's corn.
Right. And what's going to happen, I mean, if you go to Lester Brown, and he has a much more in-depth sort of scientific analysis of biofuel, and I'm glad he's weighing in on the issue because he's been studying food issues for many, many years. He was the first one to predict that China would start importing grain. And he's got, just in the last couple of years, has started producing some really good articles on it. I think his organization is Earth Policy Institute, if I've got it right. But anyway, if you search Lester Brown, you can find him. And he points this out. The disparity of buying power in the global market means that people who own cars can buy the food right out from under the people who need just to eat. And a lot of the world still survives on a grain-based diet. And, you know, with that inequality in place, biofuel is kind of nuts. And yet that's what we're pursuing. And there could be tremendous fallout from that, and it could be very soon.
I mean, I guess it's just a small sample of what you're talking about. But I read and saw a couple of news articles on TV about the cost of tortillas in Mexico, about how they had doubled or tripled because there was less corn for the average tortilla maker to use, because the cost had gone up so much because of the use for it to be diverted into ethanol.
It's happening very quickly. I mean, I was very alarmed when biofuel just started ramping up a few years ago, and I have to say I'm stunned at how quickly it's moving. Last year, every year the United States increases its grain production. It also increases the amount of energy it puts into its agricultural system, which is another issue. But last year, the entire increase in corn production in the United States went into ethanol. It was not exported to feed the world's growing population. In the United States, one must also recognize, at this point, imports almost as much food as it exports. We export grain, and we import meat and fruit and other things. It's almost even at this point. But a lot of poor people in the world who can't afford to buy beef do live off of American corn and American wheat, and biofuel is already having... excuse me, an impact on those prices, and could have a dramatic impact. Right now, global grain supplies are at like a 34-year low. For the past 6 or 7 years, we've used more grain than we've produced. Very alarming to think about not only, you know, what does this mean for our civilization, but simply how unaware we are of the impacts of these things. And I think, you know, again, I think this is, it's not an accident. It's not just something that just happened. I think our culture is fairly systematically unaware.
When you say it's not an accident, to me that says that it's intentional.
Intentional in an evolutionary sense.
Okay, so not as though somebody said, you know, screw them. I'd rather have my car than let, you know, I'm not concerned about those people eating.
No, I mean, I think, you know, there is an ideology that growth and industrialism is good for everybody. And, you know, if and when we do have food riots in the third world, which may be fairly soon, you know, that it'll probably have a different political explanation. And in fact, there were quite a few food riots in the 1980s when the IMF was doing their thing in terms of third world debt. And, you know, it's not that the average American necessarily hears about that. But the deeper point there is simply that we don't tend to be aware of these sort of broader cultural processes, or, you know, where our energy comes from, or the impacts it has on other people.
All right, feel free to dial us up. 11:49 on the wake-up call with Alexis Ziegler and his book, Culture Change. Alexis is an author and a civil activist, talking about a lot of interesting topics today. We had a handful of phone calls early in the program, first half hour. Second half hour, everybody's just sitting back and listening. Stretch out your finger and dial us up. I do want to thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support today. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom T-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. By the way, Alexis here this week. I got a couple shows lined up for the future, but you're always welcome to email me. abstractme@aol.com for suggestions, topics, whatever. That is an open email address. Don't be sending me your spam, though. all right, Alexis, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, if you want to dial up. One of the more interesting lines that I found in the book, that which unifies makes us strong, that which unifies makes us blind. And I attributed that when we were chatting earlier, I attributed that to some, you know, it was some famous quote that you'd plucked out of somewhere to go with that chapter. But you wrote that.
Yeah,
I'd like you to explain that a little bit.
That's the fundamental dilemma that I think humanity has faced. Again, going back to the stress response process, you know, I'm not going to speculate too much 50,000 years ago when human beings were hunter-gatherers, to what extent they were aware of their own cultural evolution. But I do think it became a much more difficult process as cultures grew larger. The stress response process they went through was as populations grew and as easily accessed resources were depleted, they developed these systems of leadership. At first, they were just village big men, a guy who would get up in the morning and run around the village and say, okay, everybody, get up, we got to get to work, we got to produce more. And they had these competitive feasts. Villages would compete with each other to throw the most lavish feasts. And that was kind of a charismatic leadership. And over time, you know, warfare, as populations grew, the warfare grew more intense. These village leaders became war leaders. And I think what grew out of that was this socially stratified society we have, and our means of creating conformity, of creating a unified society is we do it through child rearing. We have this elaborate process by which we condition people to live in this mass society to kind of accept the hierarchy that we have. And I don't want to go off too far in Piaget and developmental theory in a few minutes, but I do think there's the way we raise our children in these stratified societies like ours is very different than the way small cultures do it. We keep children in hierarchical groups throughout the whole period growing up. So as very small children, you know, middle school, high school, and then even in college, kids in college have no vote, no say over the organization of the university, and we think that's normal. What I think that does is it takes a certain set of childhood thought patterns. When we're small children, it's very natural for us to have this kind of, we don't analyze, you know, our parents and God and these institutions of our culture. We have this sort of deferential way of looking at them, and also the way small children's cognitive structures are organized, they have this sort of sense of personal safety in those higher institutions. And I think by keeping children in those hierarchical social structures the whole time they're growing up, they keep those institutions of higher power, they keep this sort of emotional relationship of feeling safety in those institutions of higher power, and of not criticizing them too much. And, you know, we could talk at more length about all of that and about various other aspects of our society. But the point of it is that this process of creating unity in a big culture systematically makes people less aware in that culture of the fundamental social structure of their own society. It's a terrible conundrum that our species has faced. In order to bring people together, to get them to work harder, to get them to fight, to get them to build empires, which you can say whether or not you think that was a good thing, at the same time has divorced people from a social analysis of that whole process, of understanding their own culture, of understanding their own process of cultural change. And the fact that we've become a very class-divided society, I think, you know, Exxon spends millions of dollars now trying to tell people that global warming doesn't exist. And, you know, there are countless other examples of sort of powerful entities that suppress different aspects of social reality.
We got a call from Frank. Hey, Frank.
Yes. Hello. I regret to say I didn't listen to the full program. I tuned in late, and perhaps Alexis has covered this, but since we're getting toward the end of the program, I'd be interested in just asking again for the average middle-class American, which I am, what are your top five recommendations about my contribution to helping move us forward toward a reduced energy consumption and all the consequences on the environment.
Hey, Frank?
Yeah.
You have a computer?
I do.
www.cvillepodcast.com.
Okay.
And we'll be up about, hopefully about 1:30, usually mid-afternoon on Sundays, and you can click and listen to the whole thing. Everything that you missed for whatever lame reason you had for not being here at 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I'll let Alexis answer your question. Thanks so much.
I appreciate the tip. I can catch up on the good information being shared today.
All right, Alexis, fire away.
Well, I think, you know, the personal things that people can do, you know, recycling and riding a bike and getting energy-efficient light bulbs, those things are all good. I strongly encourage people to do those things. I think the real fundamental difference, though, is in the social organization. We've become a very nucleated society, and we tend to try to sell the solutions to these problems in a nucleated sense. You know, make your own private home more efficient, make your own private car more efficient, whatever. I think the most important thing we can do at this point is to start building the social networks that we're going to need to address these problems. And I think those social networks were much stronger, of course, before our culture became so nucleated. But, you know, that's a much harder thing to say because it's more ephemeral. You know, it's not as easy as going out and buying the efficient light bulb. Sure, go ahead and buy the efficient light bulbs. That's cool. I have them in my house. No harm. But I think, you know, getting involved in groups, there's, of course, a lot of groups around. I think once you get involved in any group, it will lead you to your sort of natural what you're good at or whatever. But I emphasize that's what I encourage people to do. Get involved in the social networks, the groups that are trying to work on these issues.
Toss out a couple websites. Frank said he had a computer. What are some of the – and, you know, and let's I don't want to demean other people, and I hate doing that. But one of my methods of approaching this program, and not this hour, but the wake-up call in general, is to be – because I am the average person who's learning something as we go along. Don't send me to the web link that's going to, you know, confuse me at the beginning because it's from the academic, you know, start. Send me to the handful of web links where I can work my way up, where I'm going to read it. I'm going to go, oh, okay, that makes sense to me. And I'm going to learn something from that and then move, you know, up the list and learn as I go along in the pyramid fashion.
I don't know if I have a litany of websites that'll do that for you or not.
Well, and I'm not asking for that, but I'm asking that you don't send me to the top academic places at the beginning. Send me to some of the ones, you know, to some of the ones where I can learn pretty easily in the beginning.
Right. Well, the local group that looks at peak oil, sevillepeakoil.org. There's a local barter network that's on the tradelocal.org site. There's Power Down. Oh, my goodness.
So tradelocal.org.
Tradelocal, sevillepeakoil.org.
Sevillepeakoil.
Yeah. If you go to, again, energybulletin.net, there's a lot of peak oil sites out there. There's some of them.
Can you just Google peak oil?
Just Google peak oil. Google power down is a phrase that's often used. There's a power down.
One word or two word phrase?
One word.
So you put it together.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and even if you, personally, I think that, I think activism is good for the soul. So even just going to, you know, Charlottesville Center for Peace and Justice and get involved in anti-war work, you know, there'll be people there who talk about, you know, issues. You can sort of find your own path. I think getting involved in anything is better than what we're doing. I think our society has become, I think our economy speaks to our society that it kind of gives us information. The information it's giving us right now is, that everything is okay, and that's kind of a lie, and that people are responding to that. I think people need to get much more politically involved. And also, I want to plug, while I've got a minute, the book opening for my book is this Wednesday at New Dominion Bookstore at noon. That's New Dominion. It's toward the easterly end of the downtown mall, 12 noon on Wednesday.
All right. Alexis Ziegler, local author and civil activist, here on WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Alexis, one more time, you'll be at the New Dominion Bookstore. What day?
Wednesday, 12 noon.
So this coming Wednesday,
yep, few days January from now. 31st.
Tradelocal.org.
Yep.
Charlottesville Peak Oil.
.org. My website is conev.org.
Power Down.
Google
phrase.
Yeah. The Oil Drum, energybulletin.net.
Alexis Ziegler, Culture Change, Civil Liberty, Peak Oil, and End of Empire is his book. Alexis, thanks for coming on and teaching me, and hopefully other folks got something out of that as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, next week, still in the air. Send me an email. Tell me what I should be doing. George is up next with Les Temps Perdue.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.rlc.net. The wake-up call is produced by Michael Strickland. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake-Up Call, only on WNRN.